Welcome to the Casey Kohar Show, a celebration of words. My guest today is Stephen White. He's making his fourth or fifth appearance on the show. We're not sure which. Today we'll be discussing his new book called The Siege, published by Dutton. So first of all, Stephen, thanks so much for being a guest on the show again.
It's always my pleasure, Casey. Thanks for having me.
Stephen, The Siege is a fascinating book, and as soon as I started it, I was drawn into the style. So let's start with the style, and I even enjoyed the you have a map of the Yale campus, which you could talk about, but I love the epigram from Cole Porter from 1934, which says, "In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now, heaven knows, anything goes." And if you would, you know, just tell the listeners how that fits into the theme of the siege.
I will be happy to do that, but so that listeners are not confused, you apparently read the advanced reader's copy of The Siege with the complete epigraph in it, and I was forced to pair that epigraph in the final version for fair use reasons. And at this point, all the reader will see are the last two lines of Cole Porter's tremendous lyrics, and that's, "And now God knows, anything goes." I think it reads much better the way that you originally quoted it, but the lawyer said that I was using too much of Mr. Porter's song without permission.
That's an interesting addendum anyway for aspiring writers to know how the process works.
Absolutely. I've been doing this for almost 20 years, and I still learn things and still get frustrated by things.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the perfect epigraph for the story. It's evocative of all that is Yale. Cole Porter was a Yalie. I think he graduated back in the days before the Great Depression, and he actually wrote that song in 1934. And he was talking, obviously, about a different type of Everything Goes. And when I revisited those lyrics and thought about what is going on in our world in terms of terrorism, I thought that, you know, by looking at his words from a totally different direction, they fit the themes in my book perfectly. So in my mind, it's all that an epigraph is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. And the map at the start of the book, was that a way to just kind of introduce the reader of kind of what to expect? Or did you just kind of put that in there so that as the reader proceeds through the novel that they can refer back to this and kind of get a sense of the location?
I think it ended up being a little bit of both. There were actually two drawings initially. And any kind of art that's put in the front matter is the writer's responsibility, not the publisher's. So as I was writing the book, and I realized that the sense of place was just so crucial to the story, and even the interrelationships of certain buildings and certain streets. And I knew that I was asking a lot of the reader to keep the geography in his or her head. So I decided very early on that I wanted a grid map of the few blocks where the story takes place in New Haven, Connecticut. So that was pretty much a no-brainer for me. The second drawing was actually a much more evocative drawing in a way, and that was a 3D version of the block where the primary buildings that are the focus of the story take place. And what that did was give an upfront version of the architecture for readers. And the architecture is important to the story, the sense of place at Yale is important to the story, the interrelationship of the buildings are all important to the story, and this is the first time in my career that I've commissioned art, and the publisher ultimately decided that they preferred to have a photograph of the primary building that's in the story, the Book and Snake Tomb,
mm-hmm.
and that took up the space in the front matter where the second drawing was going to go.
Okay. And when you it seems that as an admirer of your writing, it seems with different books you challenge yourself in different ways. And this one has seemed to me like your control of time. You really did a really nice use of the control of time to create tension inside this, because it takes place over the course of 2 or 3 days in April. And and again, one of the things I like with my favorite writers is that they give the reader the benefit of the doubt when it comes to being able to figure some things out. And if you would talk about, there's a very specific way you open the book, and then you give us the time and what day it is and this kind of thing, and you move back and forth. So how did you control time with this?
First, I want to just tell you that I completely endorse what you just said about readers. You know, one of the conversations I had with my publisher when they had seen, about a third of the pages of this book, was whether I was asking too much of readers in the way that the book was structured in regard to time. And I said, I don't think so. You know, I've asked a lot of readers in the past, and they've never disappointed me. And they certainly seem to have had no problem at all with what I'm asking them to do as they follow along in this story. What I do in this story is take a tale that I could have told in a purely linear fashion, just go from point A to point Z and touch the spots along the way. It would have been an interesting story, but it would have robbed it of immediacy and tension, because everyone would have known what was going on at every point in time. So I recognized, as soon as I decided I wanted to tell this story, that telling it in a nonlinear fashion would have a logarithmic effect on its power for the reader. And what I decided to do was to take advantage of the fact that I have basically three protagonists who all know a different level of facts about this story at various points in time, and to allow the reader to get introduced to information as various ones of that trio learn it. And that means jumping back and forth in time in order to maximize the tension and to answer the questions of the who, why, when, and where in out-of-sequence orders. I start the book with a warning letter that is sent out to some parents, and don't create any context for that letter for quite a few pages, and then move to an event that takes place once the events of the siege are finally beginning to get a little clearer to everyone. But it turns out it's about halfway through the story. And then I back off and help the reader get some of the backstory that leads up to the events that are taking place in New Haven.
Mm-hmm. And just so people have the listeners and readers have a frame of reference, this is about a whole new level of terrorism that we're exposed to in the siege, that is once the reader begins to grasp the focus and the depth of the terrorist threats, it really makes sense. I mean, you get it. There's a certain point where you say, oh, I understand.
There was a time for me in the months, maybe even the weeks after 9/11, where I was watching and reading, like everybody else, everything that was out there about, you know, this terrorist threat that was suddenly in our face as a country. And over the succeeding months and years, I began to question whether our government was spending too much energy and too much resources trying to protect us from the last attack rather than to anticipate what the next one might be.
Mm-hmm.
And as a storyteller, I began to imagine what in my head I started calling the evolution of terror. And what that meant to me is, what if terrorists aren't willing to settle for creating a bigger truck bomb or, you know, bringing down 10 jetliners with shampoo bombs or, you know, blowing up the next big shopping mall with AK-47s. What if they're thinking at a scale that is just so much bigger than any of us had imagined? And the idea I had in my head is, what if there's a terrorist out there who's as smart as the guys who founded Google? What if there's a terrorist out there who is as good at killing Americans as Apple is at cool? And I thought, what would we do? What do we have resource-wise as a country to stop someone who is not only that determined, but also that smart? And I very much wanted this book to be about that evolution of terror, the perception that the threats can be atypical and be much, much more dangerous and exist on a scale that most of us haven't even considered, and that they don't require armies and great wealth to pull off.
Mm-hmm. And we're not giving any of the plot line away when I say that the thing, they could just go right for the jugular of what is the most important thing to a person of great wealth. Money is not an important element to people with great wealth. They can get more. Their family members are a different matter, and that's what I thought part of the brilliance of the plot was. If it would have been anything else, I would have said, well, they'll come up with a way to come up with the money or something like that. But the way you unroll the plot, you just say, wow, these people are in trouble.
Yeah, as the book is beginning to unfold, it's easy for the reader to fall into the gentle trap I set, to believe that this is about money, which is what some of the law enforcement people want to believe as the story begins to unfold, that because rich people are involved, this must be about money. And, you know, there's a point in the book where two of the main characters look at each other and say, this is about ammunition. And that's really the point where I hope the reader takes a step back and says, now I see it. Now I know what we're talking about.
My guest today is Stephen White. We're discussing The Siege, recently published by Dutton. And Stephen, in your novels, one of the things I think that your readers always enjoy is there's always a very, I won't say always, but there's usually a complex relationship. And Christopher Poe and Deirdre Drake are a very fascinating couple. And if you would, talk for a minute about how you use these two very damaged people who form this bond and become an integral part of the plot.
You know, I ended up adoring these two people.
Mm-hmm. I did too.
I was writing the book, and that surprised me. Poe is a character who's been around in my head for half a dozen years. I actually created part of this character originally for a spec screenplay I wrote back in 2002. The screenplay had to do with hurricanes, and it was a wonderful story, but it too was a terrorism story, and the conventional wisdom in Hollywood was that it was too soon after 9/11 to tell that kind of terrorism story. And so I set it aside, but I always hung on to the Poe character, and almost no one will know this fact, but Jeffrey Deaver and I wrote a dramatic television series pitch in 2004, and Jeff brought a lot of wonderful pieces to that pitch, and one of the pieces I brought was Christopher Poe. So Poe was part of not only my earlier screenplay, but he was part of this TV pitch that Jeffrey and I made in 2004, unsuccessfully, I might add. So Poe has been growing as a character in my mind for a while, and I really expected that he was going to be the complementary protagonist to Sam Purdy in this story. The Deirdre Drake character, I knew I needed somebody in that kind of capacity to introduce some facts during the story,
mm-hmm.
and I expected her to be very much a secondary character. She shows up, I think, around page 30 in the story, and almost immediately I had a sense that this woman's not going away. And after I wrote a few scenes that included her, I realized that without her, Poe's character loses much of his depth and almost all of his context. And I just decided to let the two of them go. And I'm really pleased with how they played off each other and how rich they are as characters, how I think believable they are as professionals, but as you point out, how damaged they are as people trying to recover from their own horrors.
Yeah, and along those lines, before we talk about Sam Purdy, I grew up in a very small town, and I remember there was a veteran in the town that I lived, Urecksville, Ohio, that anytime a car would backfire or something, he was what they referred to as shell-shocked back then. And I can remember the first time I saw him jump under a bench or something, I started laughing, and I remember my grandmother being very stern with me, telling me that was not funny, that this had happened to him in the war. And I think it's an effective use that some of the characteristics that you give Poe, that it's important that we remember the damage that people have incurred living in the world we live in today.
I think it's terribly important. You know, I think people of my generation remember an entire generation of peers that came back from Vietnam suffering post-traumatic stress from that experience. And I think it's very important to recognize that we now have two subsets of soldiers, those that fought in the first Gulf War and those that have been in Iraq and Afghanistan, that are also coming back haunted by their experiences. And as a professional, as a psychologist, I had the privilege and the obligation and responsibility to treat a number of people who had severe post-traumatic stress disorder. And I tried to bring some of that understanding to Poe's character and some of the necessary sense of empathy and understanding to Deirdre's as she becomes really his anchor and his lifeline for finding a way in the world despite the damage that he suffered.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, Stephen, we've been talking for a few minutes here and we haven't even mentioned Sam Purdy, who's by far the most well-known character in The Siege for your fans. And Sam is having a little trouble on the job, and he ends up thinking he's going on a little getaway, and he ends up to his eyeballs in this. And if you would tell us how Alan Gregory's sidekick ended up stealing the show in The Siege.
As I was originally putting this story together, and this one has a long genesis, the little pieces of this go back all the way to Y2K, pieces of the story that I couldn't quite get to fit. And when the pieces finally started to tumble together, and it was probably in about 2006 that occurred, I originally conceptualized this story as being one that would be narrated by Alan Gregory, my primary protagonist, and that he would have a patient whose child was one of the kidnapped victims, and that the patient would be somehow in touch with the child, and that Alan would hear about this stuff secondhand. And I realized that I was creating so much distance from the events back to the narrator that I was going to lose a tremendous amount of power as a storyteller. And it was about that time that my editor and a couple of other people as well asked me the same question, which was, have you ever thought about doing a book just for Sam? And I remember thinking, yeah, I could do this for Sam. And almost immediately I had this image of this engagement party celebration in Florida, and I knew I had a device that would allow him to get to New Haven. And I played a little bit with Sam being a fish out of water character in an earlier book called Blinded, and I loved writing Sam being a stranger in a strange land. I feel that he's a character who really works well in that environment. So I was quite comfortable having him in Florida and then having him amongst the wealthy, which is a place he has no experience, and finally ending up in a situation that he can't even imagine in New Haven, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's a little bit of a cat and mouse game between Sam and Christopher and Deirdre, and so that becomes fun as well. And it's also, I think it was interesting in the times that we live in that Sam was dealing with some fairly harsh economic realities. And this is, I like it when the fiction that I read reflects what's going on in the world, and Sam's not walking around with a Black American Express card with an unlimited credit limit, and he has to live within the means that he has, which are very tight at the moment. And I thought that led a depth to the novel that I liked.
You know, a number of interesting things came together for me along those lines in writing the story. One certainly was Sam's economic woes. You know, readers of the series will know that Sam had been out of a job for a while, and that his being out of a job certainly predated some of the economic hardships that the country has suffered. But, you know, once I realized that Sam was far from alone in his economic hardship, I decided, you know, to take advantage of that, and I highlighted it intentionally in this story. Along the same lines, one of the very secondary subplots in this story has to do with the danger of out-of-control flu. And I wrote that entire section of the story before any of the H1N1 swine flu epidemic started this past year. So, you know, that also seems to have an immediacy that I certainly didn't intend, but that events have made very real.
That is interesting. Stephen, I think that in 2006 you wrote a book called Kill Me, which is one of my favorites. I've recommended it to a lot of people. And I think the people that enjoyed Kill Me will enjoy The Siege as well as your regular readers. And what would you say, what are you happiest with about The Siege when you look back at it with where you started and this being part of your body of work now? What are you happiest with now about The Siege, that it's now available in the bookstores and online, etc.?
I would tend to agree with you, first of all, Casey, that readers who were captivated by Kill Me, which was an unusual story for my series at the time that I wrote it, will likely find similar interest in The Siege, which is, again, an unusual story for me as a series crime fiction writer, because most of my books are centered around the same group of people in and around Boulder, Colorado, and this one is not. It involves one series character who, you know, the reality is I could have written this story without Sam Purdy in it. I don't think it would have been as rich, but I could have done that. So this book is different from many of the series books, and although there is a minority of readers of my work who were disappointed in Kill Me because it did not focus on the series characters in Boulder the way some of the others did, I think most readers have been very supportive and very encouraging about my telling stories that I feel can't be told within the confines of the ensemble of characters in Boulder. What am I proud of about this story? You know, I really wanted this to be, A, about something. I wanted it to be the kind of story that when you finish the book, you don't stop thinking about it. And I think that has a lot in common with Kill Me, which I wanted to haunt people. I wanted the premise of that story to be something that didn't go away when you turned the last page. And I knew when I was writing The Siege that I was certainly writing about something that I think is powerful and important and worthy of some thought beyond the story. And I think I've succeeded in doing that with this. I also wanted to write a book that, despite the fact that it was about something serious, was also completely relentless. I did not want there to be pages in this story where the reader felt, oh, now I can stop and go to bed. I wanted it to be just completely relentless. I wanted it to feel like one of those thrillers that if you had to put it down, you wanted to go back and pick it up at the earliest possible time.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Stephen, before I let you go, I wanted to, and we're discussing The Siege, published by Dutton, written by Stephen White. The other thing that we haven't mentioned is it does have the element of kind of like a locked room mystery as well. It kind of has that classic mystery element to it, that despite all the advances in technology and all of the things that we're learning, the fact that these guys are in an impenetrable building really ratchets up the tension as well. So it kind of has that old classic British locked room mystery feel to it as well.
Well, you know, and I've been talking about this book for a few weeks now, and you're the first person who's commented on that or asked me about it, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to talk about it. One of the other ways I was conceptualizing the story when I decided to tell it was based on my awareness as a moviegoer of Spielberg's Jaws, if you remember that movie.
Mm-hmm. Very well.
And as a moviegoer, I loved the first half of Jaws before the fish showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And I just sort of liked the second half of Jaws after mm-hmm. the fish showed up. And I wanted this book to have the feel of the first half of Jaws, the part before the shark. And I fought and fought for a way to tell the story without ever revealing the terrorists or the hostages.
Mm-hmm.
I never wanted to go inside that locked room. I wanted the reader to have to experience the sense of frustration and the sense of not knowing that all the characters are dealing with throughout the story. And I said earlier that this book had a long gestation period. The reason it had such a long gestation is that I couldn't find a realistic way to tell the story that would cut off these hostages from the world in plain sight for an extended period that would still thwart the law enforcement's best efforts to rescue them. And one day, as I was walking through the Yale campus, and set eyes on a different tomb, not the Book and Snake tomb that's featured in the book, but another more famous tomb called Skull and Bones, I remember looking at that building and saying, this building's a fort. And that day I realized that all these ideas that I'd been toying with for so many years, I suddenly had a way to tell the story. And it was solely because of the building and the way the building is used. And if I did not have that device, I'm not sure I would have been able to pull the disparate parts of this story together.
That's interesting. Very good. Well, Stephen, it's been a pleasure talking to you today. And I wish you the best of luck with The Siege. I found it, the word you used, relentless, that's a word I would use as well. And it's a book that it's hard to find a place to put a bookmark in it because you want to find out what happens next. So I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I really appreciate you taking time today to talk with us. And I look forward to getting caught up with you when the next book comes out. And congratulations on writing what I think is a real winner.
Well, thank you very much, Casey. And, you know, I'm grateful for the opportunity to have an intelligent conversation about the book, and you always bring that to the table, and I'm thankful for the chance.
Great. Well, thanks so much. Well, Stephen, you take care, and we'll catch up both you down the road.
Sounds great. Thanks, Casey.
You've been listening to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. My guest today was Stephen White. We've been discussing The Siege, published by Dutton. Strongly recommended. Available in your bookstores and online now.